Hello, I am Jack Murtha, and this is Databook.
And I'm Tom Castles, your co-host. If you like this healthcare analytics news podcast, please subscribe, rate, and review.
But first, boy, oh boy, do we have a story for you today. So it's a gray and rainy November day. And on this day, one of the most anticipated hospitals of the early 1990s is officially in financial ruins. It's called Healthcare International, or HCI for short, and it's only been open for just longer than 4 months.
HCI's big red brick buildings sit outside of Glasgow. That's Scotland's largest city. But today, they're pretty much empty. Some somber-looking hospital employees are walking the halls, but it's mostly quiet and deflated.
There's also an Associated Press journalist on the prowl. And this journalist is documenting the scene of a company that had just gone into receivership.
This means court officials are checking to see just what's left and what's valuable here, and how it can help HCI make good on its broken obligations.
So this journalist gets the head of the company in front of the camera, and he looks rankled.
That's because right up until this morning, he figured HCI was going to make it. But at the very last minute, a single investor, this French banker, pulls out. And just like that, their money is gone.
So this journalist goes and talks to some angry Scottish politicians, and they pretty much never liked Healthcare International. And that is certainly not changing today.
Meanwhile, far away, across the pond in the U.S., vendors are freaking out. They have millions of dollars in the line tied up in contracts with HCI.
And many of these vendors are super high-tech. Keep in mind, it's 1994.
That's because Healthcare International was super high-tech, even for after 1994.
In fact, this was the world's first paperless hospital.
This place was going to bring in a new era for healthcare.
For hospitals.
For patients.
But the tech, that wasn't the problem. Everything that the hospital was doing with these fancy vendors seems like it was going to work out. That wasn't why the receivers came and the bankers left. The tech was not why this big, impressive hospital had come to feel more like a funeral home, at least on this day.
So I'm sure at this point you're wondering exactly what sunk this hospital, Healthcare International. What doomed this facility that Bloomberg had called a gleaming temple to high-tech medicine?
And what can healthcare in 2018 learn from a hospital that was supposed to change everything in 1994?
So Jack and I are going to take you back to the summer of 1994. It's when Healthcare International first opens its doors.
And again, it's gray and rainy. And I guess that's Scotland for you, Tom. But nothing can really distract from the promise of this $370 million hospital with its something like 260 beds and even an attached luxury hotel.
Once again, we have journalists running all over the place, all through the halls of HCI with cameras. They're filming clinicians fiddling with computers, people printing documents in an instant, doctors digitally searching through patient records, and even a woman, you're not going to believe this, using a computer mouse.
Well, that stuff was a big deal back then, and it was why HCI was such a big deal. Computer World, this magazine, even ran a story about the hospital and how its entire digital information system was being built from the ground up. And guess what the writer called it? He said that to be in charge of that was a dream job.
HCI was working at the time with this company that you may have heard of called Cerner.
Who?
I said Cerner, Jack. On a big first-of-its-kind EMR project, HCI was using high-speed printers and scanners in the hospital. It had even designed its operating rooms for an intraoperative MRI.
That's a mouthful.
Yeah, which didn't exist yet.
It didn't exist yet, but it was in the works. But even the floors of this place were better than other hospitals. The floors could hold the type of weight that this high-tech medical equipment of the future required. And other providers, they had to shove these big machines in the basement because they have concrete floors. This was not the case at HCI.
HCI doctors were also rethinking medicine, of course. They got a lot of applause for their work with anesthesia, for instance.
And when you look at the big picture, HCI was the product that you could only really get from a star-studded team of technologists and clinicians.
With a little bit of help from some deep-pocketed backers.
That's true. But from the start, this big deal, HCI, was also a pretty big controversy.
Let's take a little look at the history here. Healthcare International was the vision of a couple of American doctors with ties to Harvard. They wanted to make a super high-tech, top-of-the-line hospital to serve foreign patients from places like parts of Europe and the Middle East.
Medical tourism was pretty popular at the time. People in countries like the United Arab Emirates, they traveled for treatment. It was no biggie.
So these doctors are connected to bankers and investors and healthcare experts. They even get Harvard in on the action.
I believe it owns a 21% stake, but I could be wrong. Anyway, everybody who's involved in this spends the 1980s looking for a place where they can enact this grand vision and make some money. Finally, they settle on Scotland, in a little town called Clydebank, which is just 15 minutes from the Glasgow airport.
The trouble starts right away. The locals don't really like the idea of Healthcare International. It's not even supposed to take care of them when they're sick.
And it's a private hospital in a country with free healthcare. Plus, what makes it even weirder is HCI gets at least $30 million in public money. The government thinks that HCI is kind of like an economic investment. It'll create a couple hundred jobs, maybe a couple thousand jobs. And this whole thing just rubs people the wrong way. People from outside of Clydebank are going to be coming in there to receive treatment that the Clydebank residents see themselves as paying for.
The locals sure aren't happy about it. There are even engineering issues on the property, which used to be a shipyard. Everything just sort of adds up and some really bad publicity ensues.
And that continues even on opening day. Here are a couple headlines here. If I had a newspaper, I'd be cracking it open right now, but not many people have them anymore. Hospital opens door to single patient.
How about this one too? A trailblazing patient rests in lap of luxury.
So right off the bat, HCI is getting hammered in the press, and that's something that never really changes. It goes on to deal with scandals related to blood donations, money, which is ever persistent, and even a guest who brought a prostitute into the hotel.
Oh boy. The big issue here is really the lack of patients. They just were not walking in through HCI's doors, at least not in the numbers that the hospital needed in order to survive and thrive.
It turns out that medical tourism is on the decline, at least back then. Oil-rich Middle Eastern nations are building their own hospitals, and they're pretty good at what they do. Also, it's not clear if people really want to go to Glasgow like they would, I don't know, London, New York.
So as time rolls along here, a lot of this great new tech isn't being used to its full potential.
This great new place isn't being used to its full potential.
And that means, like any business, it's burning through its cash. Any new hospital needs a large runway, a big safety net in order to make it. But Healthcare International's coffers are just simply drying up.
And there are some internal problems among investors. Not everyone is on the same page. And then, all of a sudden, it's November, and there's this one banker, this one financial supporter, who says, "Forget this, I'm done." And that's it. HCI is done.
But it's not totally done.
No, it's not. Because that same year, a business called the Abu Dhabi Investment Company, they swoop in and they buy HCI.
For a brief moment, everybody's smoking cigars, things look pretty good. A prince from the United Arab Emirates says that the government is going to pay to send over 50 to 80 patients per month.
That is a nice guarantee. Is it still enough? Probably not. So this new incarnation of HCI is also trying to entice wealthy patients from abroad. Hey, come here. We will make your medical experience the best around.
Eventually, the National Health Service faces some shortages, and it strikes a deal with the hospital to take some of its public patients. Still, though, things aren't working out how they should.
So the years are passing, and HCI is just floating. And less than a decade after it opens, the NHS buys Healthcare International, and it renames it the Golden Jubilee Hospital.
It's beautiful.
And with that, Tom, this whole ordeal fades into memory.
Now, there are a lot of lessons we can take away from this HCI story, but most of them aren't just right for this podcast.
We did get one striking lesson from someone who worked there, from someone who helped design it from before it was open. And you might have heard of him, Dr. Nick. He is Nick Vanterhaeden, and he told us that the hospital did not flop due to the tech. And that's pretty much widely agreed upon. But he said one major learning point, and I quote, was the inability of other facilities, doctors, and patients to deal with digital records.
Sound familiar? It was clear, even way back then, that everything that made up the data and digital skeleton of Healthcare International was the future. And one day, there would be other HCIs, but with one big difference.
They would succeed.
So that guy we just name-dropped, Nick Vanterhaeden, he was kind enough to join us on this episode of Databook. Dr. Nick has some clout in the world of health IT. He formerly worked for years as a clinician before becoming chief medical officer of Dell for a time. Currently, you might know him as an active tweeter, one of many HIMSS social media ambassadors, and the current CEO of Incremental Healthcare.
So Dr. Nick isn't here to discuss the dark days and misery that sort of dogged the world's first paperless hospital. On the contrary, he is here to discuss what it was like to launch something so ahead of its time, this all-encompassing EMR system. And he's here to pass on lessons that he learned from that endeavor. Perhaps most important, Dr. Nick is here to discuss what healthcare needs to know going forward during this time of immense change, but still not yet realized tech ambitions. So, Dr. Nick, welcome to Databook.
Hi, thanks very much for having me on the show.
So how did you get involved in healthcare technology in the first place?
That would probably be almost the first day of entering medical school when I launched into this world that was, to me, behind the times in terms of technology. I had already spent time at my school in the lead up to coming to medical school as a programmer. I'd built solutions that essentially simulated a mass spectrometer for physics experiments. I'd used terminals and punch cards to create innovations. I'd actually done a population health project. As I walked into the healthcare system, I looked around to find that there was almost no technology. And what there was relatively limited in use and was really not being applied in any form that I could see was going to deliver value. And all I could see was an opportunity and a potential to change that. And I've spent pretty much my career both educating and refining that to help many of my colleagues who struggle with this technology because it hasn't provided value in some instances and they're not aware of the opportunity.
Now, shifting over to Healthcare International, what was the EMR like? How did you go about building it? What was the end product?
In the early days when we were doing this, the tradition was very much build your own. And again, part of that cooperative relationship between individuals coming from different countries, different backgrounds and experiences, allowed us to take what was in those days a very new approach. And instead of building our own system, we capitalized on existing technology that was imperfect at the time and didn't have a full suite. And that company was Cerner. And Cerner's system at the time was mainly focused around laboratory systems. It lacked a lot of the modules that exist today. But despite that, our plan and implementation used that foundation, worked closely with Cerner. And in fact, it became a key site for them to bring customers to say, this is the future. This is what could be. Good examples of that out in the wards, you know, they had ward and bed management systems to some degree, but no real concept or limited concepts around in-room technology. So we had a view that technology should be in the room. The idea that a patient sits in isolation, you attend to them, handwrite something perhaps, and then come out and document elsewhere, to us seemed wrong. We wanted to install technology into the rooms, but there was no capacity for showing or sharing that. The tools for capturing that information were, you know, appropriate for the time, but they were certainly limited from a clinician standpoint. And we had to find other ways. And in some instances, we found that paper was a better solution that then ended up being scanned, although it wasn't scanned intelligently. So the information didn't flow into the system in a way that could be used effectively. So we learned from those experiences. But ultimately, building solutions that clinicians could find the value and could use effectively. And a lot of that was tied to workflow.
So what about when HCI opened? What fruits did the tech yield? What insights did you come up with?
Our first patient was extraordinary in the treatment. He had significant vascular disease. He had what we would have called in that day and age a major procedure. He had advanced anesthesia that had him walking, ambulating the same day of his surgery, which was an important aspect to reducing complications. In the early days, we were limited to the patients that we had. And I think the major value proposition came from accruing data from patients that were geographically distant. So we were practicing telehealth and telemedicine. In those days, it was very challenging doing video conferencing, consultations with physicians in other countries with those patients. But we were able to capture their information. If I recall, in those days, they would fax much of the information or even courier clinical data over, but we were able to capture that, enter it, and then the consultations that would take place were essentially clinical discussions based on the value of this information that had been shared early on, and we could make informed clinical decisions about both the safety of transferring and indeed the appropriateness of transferring a patient, and where it wasn't necessary, we could help and support those patients in country with their clinical support team. We continued to sort of manage the challenge of new technology and new workflow for nurses, especially who were typically focused on a paper-driven process. We had to link physical specimens to this digitized information. So the whole process of barcoding and removing errors, but certainly some of the physicians started to develop insights. I know that the anesthesia team published a number of papers around their new form of anesthesia and showed the value of that and the ambulation, and indeed the capture of all of the information during anesthesia was now digitized and able to be presented. And we also started to innovate around some of the different techniques for minimally invasive surgery, which was still in its early days, but allowed patients to be kept for shorter periods of time and better outcomes that truly sort of founded much of the early data that allowed for some of these techniques and indeed tools to be used around the world.
So we know that a lot of doctors and health IT experts are super duper hopeful about the advantages and insights that tech like EMRs can provide for healthcare. At the same time, many others kind of see this new tech adoption, big data discovery, as an uphill battle. You've been involved in health IT since the start. What do you think?
So over the course of history, I think electronic medical records have typically held great promise, but struggled to deliver against that ideal. And in the early days, I would suggest that that was a function of spread and penetration of these solutions. So, you know, that was typified by our challenge in a very early instance where we had digital records, but we had to scan everything coming in and had to print it going out. The challenge with any digital system is that if you're isolated as a solution, then the value doesn't accrue in the same way. And that's also true within individual hospitals. So the early days of these implementation of systems started out in departments. We would implement the laboratory system or the financial system. Almost all of these systems didn't come about with a focus on clinical support or clinical value. What's interesting to me now, I still hear lots of resistance. There are plenty of folks that talk about the pain and agony of these solutions. And, you know, I can't disagree that the impact on workflow and the detraction from the focus on the patient is absolutely debilitating to a physician who went to medical school because he wants to see and talk to patients. And I think the changes that we're seeing now are starting to turn the tide. I don't think it's completely turned. Some of the continuing problems remain that we're asking physicians to be data entry clerks. They're not. So I think new technology that will start to passively absorb that information. We've obviously got speech recognition, artificial intelligence, and natural language processing that listens into content and will try to populate data and extract data, I think will start to help solve that. When you look back at the airline industry, you know, in the early 1950s and the challenge of safety, they really focused on data and improvement and indeed incremental improvement that was faultless. So reporting of problems or issues didn't look at apportioning blame, but rather looked at the root cause analysis. And ultimately, what we have is a Six Sigma system that is incredibly safe because of all the safety improvements that have been built in and the specific capability that is designed to fail safely. That's not the case in healthcare, but I think we're moving towards that direction. Technology and importantly, electronic health records have great capacity to use that data, apply that knowledge, and where elements are missing and we're failing to deliver the care that we know is the best possible care, we can deliver it into the system quickly and importantly shorten that cycle time so that when you go and see your physician, you get the best possible choices, you discuss that together. That to me is the great hope in all of this. And ultimately, if I was to look at the future, I would say, I imagine electronic health record disappearing into the fabric of the office.
All right, Dr. Nick, why don't we wrap this up with three of your biggest takeaways for the listener?
So I would characterize my experience as a journey of small incremental changes and improvements over the course of time. There were no major eureka moments that took place. There were many things that I was fortunate enough to learn. I believe that teamwork and cooperative working relationships, both with patients and indeed clinical team, was very much an element of success. And in fact, one of the early organizational charts that we used as our driving force in our hospital in Glasgow, instead of putting the CEO top of the organizational chart, we put the patient at the top of the chart. Much of knowledge and technology is very much like plutonium. If it's all scattered and not focused and concentrated, it's interesting, but it doesn't always produce value. But when you focus and bring technology and insights together on a specific problem, like plutonium, you get some incredible behavior and activity. So bringing the right teams together and focused on the details with just a zealous intention is an imperative that allows us to be successful in applying all of this technology.
All right, Dr. Nick Vanterhaeden, he has a long and storied career in healthcare. He's also programming. Right now, he is working on incremental healthcare, which he founded. And Dr. Nick, thank you for joining Databook today.
Hey, it's been a great pleasure. It's been a fantastic conversation, and I've enjoyed the discussion. Thanks for having me on the show.
So for this week's Insight, we have a very special guest. Charisse Maynard is the Managing Director of Envision Care, and even cooler, she is a contributor for Healthcare Analytics News, which, as you know by now, is the magazine attached to this podcast. Charisse is also an expert on interoperability and blockchain and healthcare policy, all this good stuff. She is a KOL and is very active on Twitter. If you're in this space and you're active on Twitter, you have no doubt come across her. So she is going to leave us with some insights about paper records and the power of EMR and everything that we kind of talked about today, where healthcare needs to go from there, from here. So Charisse, take it away.
I am surprised, actually, about the number of systems still using paper-based systems. 70% of providers still using paper-based systems. But the real issue with those systems is that it's holding back ideas behind interoperability. Now, one thing that pushes the idea of paper-based systems or supports the idea of paper-based systems is the clinicians' use of it. A lot of clinicians are not comfortable as we'd like them to be with electronic records, and we see now they're actually contributing to a physician burnout and that type of thing. However, paper systems that these clinicians are so dependent on because they believe that they're safer and that they're more available to them are actually hurting them more than if they would just move to electronic systems. We saw with the Institutes of Medicine, who were the early adopters of the idea of electronic medical records, trying to improve patient records. And they actually proposed the earliest means of converting paper to electronic records in a way that would benefit the provider, clinicians, and the patients. But unfortunately, their ideas didn't go very far to further the notion of interoperability, and nobody kind of got behind them on that. But when we look at the issue of what information a clinician needs available to them, we recognize that clinicians actually need the most actionable data possible on patients to be able to treat them. The challenge with systems, and particularly those that are still using paper, is that they're stitching together disjointed patient data from all these available sources. And we're seeing sources like the health information exchanges, the electronic medical records, the patients themselves, all these different specialty operations and that type of thing. Trying to aggregate all of that data from all these different resources is a huge challenge. Now, what organizations need to do, they need to format a data aggregation strategy that includes a record location component. And most of them don't have that because they don't understand it. But as we see organizations like CMS saying now that for participation, providers have to go to these type of systems. They have to rely less on paper and make available to patients electronic information and that type of thing. I think we'll see some of these strategies come forward, and these locator components need to be accessible by clinicians and patients. The other thing we're looking at is clinicians who don't report certain data because they don't understand it. We recently talked in one of the Twitter chats that I do about ADT data and physicians who don't report it because they prefer paper. Physicians are actually admitting that they don't know where their patients are when it's time to discharge. And ADT data, which is admission, discharge, and transfer, helps the patient transition, and it helps all those systems provide precise care to individuals. But doctors are saying they don't buy into those systems. So the notification services and stuff utilized by those systems currently are not working. And all this leads us to, you know, where do we stand with interoperability? Is it achievable? Is it a false notion? How do we get there? And I always particularly recently liken interoperability to the nation of Wakanda, because I think it's something people can relate to. It sounds amazing and beautiful and full of innovation, but no one's ever really been there or know if it actually exists. So you have to think of it in that term. And if we are all going to make systems sound for patients and sound for clinicians and work like they're supposed to work, all these different components sharing information and making it do what it needs to do, we have to understand what the job is. Why do we need this information? Where do we need it? And what is it being utilized for? And I think if we can get everybody to buy into just those simple ideals, you'll have more providers and more systems. And I don't want to say abandoning paper, because some of them will never abandon paper, but you want them to rely less on paper and more on a data aggregation strategy that includes interoperable systems. And when they focus on tasks like streamlining administrative processes and workflows, we as an industry not only have the opportunity to expedite gains in our interoperability, but we can also find what we all need is significant cost savings in healthcare.
Everybody, that is a wrap for this episode of Databook.
We want to thank you for listening, and we really encourage you to subscribe, rate, and review if you like this show, which is produced by the magazine Healthcare Analytics News.
Be sure to stop by hcanews.com for all the latest breaking information in the health IT space.
And you could also check us out on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, wherever. It is HCA_news. And please reach out to us with your recommendations for your favorite healthcare apps. If you give us something good, we can promise that it will go in the next issue of the magazine, or maybe the August issue. But anyway, thank you so much for listening to Databook. I'm your co-host, Jack Murtha.
And I'm your co-host, Tom Castles. Thanks for joining us, everybody.